Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 34. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, looking at a couple of older films for a little bit of a change, going to take a look at a story that's been told a number of times, in this case in 1960. It's called The Hands of Orlac, and it stars Merle Ferrer and Christopher Lee. A little bit of fun there. And then we're going back to 1950s space age, well, pre-space age, science fiction with Ivan Tor's GOG, starring Richard Egan and Herbert Marshall. A little bit of kind of atom punk retro stuff. Back soon. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how is everybody? Things are going okay. Here we're diving into winter at a disgusting rate, of course, and me not being a winter person, that's not a good thing at all. But nonetheless, I do have the heating on. I'm looking out on the bleak area outside the man cave window where all of the flowers are dying, and there's still a bit of green, but it's not looking too good at all. I hope everybody is doing fine. There hasn't been really much to report. We are back from our leave, where we went up to Sydney and then up to the Blue Mountains outside Sydney to chill out for a little bit, so I'm feeling kind of good. Doing a lot more exercise than I did, which is kind of nice because the waist is getting smaller and the breath is coming easier and the legs are getting stronger and all that kind of thing, so I'm not entirely unhappy with that. I do have to let you know that I've had some problems with voicemail numbers. Now, here's what the problem is with voicemail numbers. If nobody uses them within a 30-day period, they lapse. And so I know that Chris Mounts has tried to send me an email, voicemail via my old voicemail number, and it elapsed something like 24 hours before he sent it. And I've been looking for alternatives, and I've asked around a few podcast places on Facebook and other places. And to be honest with you, there's not really a good, reliable free voicemail service that I can access for this podcast. I do apologize for that. I would love to get voicemails, but I can still get them. Of course, you can send them by recording them on your computer and then saving them as MP3 files and emailing them to me at cultguru@gmail.com. I know it's not a perfect solution. It's a little less convenient than using a phone to do it, but I still want to get voicemails and I still want to get feedback, and I love the stuff. But unfortunately, the free voicemail things have died out a lot, and I can't keep giving out a voicemail number that'll probably lapse before anybody uses it. It's just not fair on you guys as an audience, and for me as a podcaster, it's a very frustrating thing as well. So I do apologize for that, but I would still love to get the feedback, so please bear with me on it, and again, I apologize. But on to much nicer stuff, and what I've been watching. I have been watching a shit ton of genre work since last I talked at you, and some of it good, some of it bad, some of it I actually want to do for the podcast at some stage in the future, but I think I want to get somebody else in to do it with me at that stage. So here's what I've watched within rough genre parameters. I did watch Invasion of the Beagles, the Nicholas Meyer written movie from the 1970s, starring William Smith and Victoria Vetri, about a bunch of women who basically become human bees. It's very much 1970s stuff. It's sexist as all hell. There's a lot of nudity in it, which is not pejorative thing as far as I'm concerned. But it's an old favourite of mine that I first saw in the cinemas way back when, and occasionally I'll re-watch it and just enjoy the silliness of it. It's about a bunch of women who kind of become, as I said, human bees, and kill their mates in the act of mating by some kind of... It's not actually laid out why they die, but they all seem to die of heart attacks very happy. Mostly because all the women who are afflicted with this particular ailment are singularly attractive. So, yeah, like I said, it's the 1970s. I did see the 2014 RoboCop, which is technically a good film, and has a lot of good technology there and a lot of good action sequences and some very fine actors in it, including Gary Oldman. But I don't think it stands up as well as the old one. And people have pointed this out before, so I'm not telling you anything new when I say that it doesn't have the satirical edge that the old one had. It does have virtues, like Samuel L. Jackson playing a kind of Fox News type pundit with wavy hair and big sideburns and stuff like that. But it's good to see as a comparison piece to the original, but I don't think that it really is kind of worth making. I think it was purely one of those cash cow projects that the studios come up with, trading on the name RoboCop and trading on the fact that they now have more technologies to tell the story with, but they didn't add anything to the story at all with that. I did hang out with my friends Jamie and Sarah, and we saw an old diesel punk classic, The Rocketeer, which is a Disney film, but isn't too bad. It's got Billy Campbell in it, it's got Jennifer Connelly in it, and it has Timothy Dalton. And it's a lot of fun. It's a guy who finds a prototype jetpack that Howard Hughes has built and uses it to beat Nazis and have a good time in general. There's a lot of nods to old movies in this. And it was directed by Joe Johnson, who directed the first Captain America movie. I got a Blu-ray of it, and the Blu-ray transfer is very good. The effects are very, very good. A lot of them were practical effects rather than anything else. And it's, it's a bit of fun and not a waste of time. Yeah, I did see a recent movie which has a lot of parallels with movies like Splice, for instance. It's a movie called The Machine, which... is an English film, not a very large budget science fiction film, but it's a very interesting story, and I do want to do it for a future podcast. It's set in the near future and stars Toby Stevenson, whose father, Robert Stevenson, was in The Asphyx, and Katie Lotz, who plays the Black Canary in the TV series Arrow. A bunch of artificial intelligence engineers come together and they want to create the first ever self-aware artificial intelligence. They do create one, and it's put into a female android body, and things move on from there. I'm not going to do any more spoilers than that on the film. It's a nice little piece of low-budget filmmaking. The characters are well-drawn and well-defined, and it does end on an interesting transhuman note. I'm not going to go any further than saying that. I think it's a much better movie from what I hear, and I haven't seen this yet, than Transcendence in some ways. I think it tells a not entirely unsimilar story. Dissimilar, that should be, not unsimilar, as Transcendence. But I think that it carries it well and doesn't go for a kind of nihilistic ending, which is kind of cool and probably makes it at least worth your while to see. So I did see that, and I do recommend it. I can't say I recommend it highly, but I do recommend it. Let's see what else I saw. I did see a documentary which I recommend to everybody listening to the podcast, Jodorowsky's Dune. It's about the attempts by Alejandro Jodorowsky in the 1970s to make the movie Dune. This is before Lynch became involved. And the cast he was going for was amazing. Orson Welles was going to be in it. Mick Jagger was going to be in it. Salvador Dali was going to be in it. It's just an amazing effort. Jodorowsky, of course, Jodorowsky, is mad as a bag full of cats. But he's still around. He's still passionate about projects. And I think his vision for the movie is at least very, very interesting. And they do talk to a lot of people who are involved in the pre-production of the movie. And came within a few million bucks of being made. And Hodorowski's ideas for making Dune are mind-blowing. They're crazy, and they may never have worked, but in spite of that, they are mind-blowing. And this documentary kind of lays out, A, the process that he went through to try to make the movie, and B, how very, very influential the vast amount of notes Hodorowski put together in book form with colour plates. The book's about, you know, it's about the size of three phone books. And he gave it out to every studio while trying to get them to make the movie. And ever since then, the studios have basically stolen from this book in order to make all sorts of other films subsequent to the failed attempt to make Dune as a movie, which it's a good documentary. And if you're a film buff, as I am, and if you're a genre film buff, I seriously recommend Hodorowski's Dune. Now, my friend Liz Travaskis and I talked about a genre film last weekend, or this weekend, actually. It was on Thursday, for our bit for ABC Local Radio in the Northern Territory. And we talked about the Robin Hardy film from 1973, The Wicker Man. And we both loved it and talked about it, and there were lots of audio clips played from it. And in general, we both enjoyed the film tremendously. Liz, being slightly younger, hadn't seen the film before, and I always like bringing to the game with Liz a movie she hasn't seen before, because I like her fresh reactions to it and her different perspective too. She's much younger than I am, and being female as well, she always brings a different angle to the movies we talk about than I do. And I do appreciate that. It keeps me on my toes, and it also gives me someone else's viewpoint when I'm talking about this stuff, and I really love that as well. Ivor and I had a great time. We had a great kind of radio bromance going, but with Liz, it's a very much a different thing, and not better, not worse, but different and challenging and fun, and I'm really enjoying that. The next movie we're going to do, I'm going to enjoy as well, and it's not genre, but we're going to look at Jacques Tati's Mon Oncle, which is another movie I recommend to everybody. So I saw that and enjoyed revisiting Summer Isle and all of that kind of thing, which, it was pretty cool. Now, I did see another movie called Island of Terror, which stars Peter Cushing and Edward Judd, about an artificial life form that some scientists create on an island while they're trying to cure cancer. And the life forms are silicon-based and basically look like pregnant carpet mats with vacuum cleaner attachments on them, and they suck all of the calcium out of your bones. So you end up being like a dead, floppy person thing. Fairly low budget, but it's a lot of fun as well. And the monsters are genuinely frightening, even, and the special effects, of course, minimal, but they use them very well. It plays like a Doctor Who episode in some ways, on that kind of low budget, small scale alien invasion thing. Though in this case, of course, the aliens are something that we made in a laboratory, which is kind of cool and interesting. And I recommend that one as well. I did see another movie which was on a double bill way back in the day with The Island of Terror. It's a movie, an English movie, starring Brian Holiday called The Projected Man. And again, it's a teleportation gone wrong film. It owes a little bit to The Fly and a few other bits and pieces of earlier cinema. And it goes back to what I've said before, based on some information passed on to me by Sean Williams, the great Australian science fiction writer, where most teleportation in movies and in media in general and in novels are basically murdering twin makers. They murder you and then they make an identical twin of you somewhere else. And this movie kind of goes in that direction as well. Things go nastily wrong. It's got the most unpleasant sounds of a teleportation device ever. The sound effects used for the machine are really nerve-gratingly bad, because basically it's just an electronic sound effect that grates on my nerves a lot. But it's not a bad little film. It's got a bit of really weird... It's got one nude scene, but it's somebody who's just got killed by the projected man. And then they kind of pull back the blanket a little too far. He gets to see her breasts. If you're going to show nudity in a movie, and I know it really is an actress who's pretending to be dead, don't show us corpse nudity. Show us nudity on someone who's alive and kind of moving around a bit, maybe. But in this case, they didn't. And I just thought, why did you bother? I mean, there's absolutely no point to that nudity. I don't mind gratuitous nudity, but there's kind of about border there and gratuitous dead chick nudity. And I shouldn't have said chick there. I apologize to all of my feminist friends. Is just not on. Anyway, what else have I seen? That's about it for the genre stuff. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take a break. And when I get back, we're going to talk about Le Mans d'Orlac, The Hands of Orlac, starring Mel Ferrer and Christopher Lee, a movie that was made in both French and English at the same time.
What's on Beth the Moon?
There are 7 moons.
7?
Hope they
Beth the Moon.
7 moons.
7?
Mm-hmm. All met for love.
Yeah.
Come along with me to my galaxy. 7 times a bleed. Every time you kiss, 7 times a charm. For girl and boy, 7 moons above, 7 times a love. Come with me to my galaxy.
Sorry about the quality of that one, but I like it so much I thought I'd play it anyway. That is Danny Saval and Tom Tryon singing 7 Moons of Beta Lyrae from the extremely bad Disney science fiction movie Moon Pilot from 1962. It's a very rare track, which explains why I could only get a pretty dodgy copy of it off YouTube. But anyway, let's get on with The Hands of Orlac.
The hands whose music thrilled the world. Are they now the hands that love to kill? Are they hands that control the man who owns them? Are they Orlac's hands? Or are they those of another human being grafted on? The hands of a killer?
Just look at these hands. They're not mine. They belong to someone else. They have their own thoughts, their own will. I can't control them.
Darling, I'm not frightened of you.
Ask, is it possible for such things to happen? We can only answer, fact is stranger than fiction. Here is a motion picture filled with startling mystery. The story of a haunting question that drives a man to the brink of insanity. Starring Mel Ferrer as Orlac, victim of a terrible accident.
You think I killed that cat, don't you?
Go on, say it!
Monsieur, please!
What are you afraid of? You think I'm going to kill you?
Co-starring Christopher Lee as Nero the Magician, who discovers the secrets of Orlac's hands and hounds him to the edge of madness.
Did you know that your charming little wife and her wise old guardian were planning to have you certified? They want to put you away.
Danny Carell as Lai Lang, who uses her charms to trap Orlak and her beauty to betray him.
Tell me something.
Yes.
What is it you're afraid of?
Lucius Saint-Simon as the wife of Orlak, who loves the man, but fears the hands that would embrace her.
Forgive me, Louise. You're not safe with me.
Uncle Francis, I've been trying to get you. Uncle Francis, he must be stopped. He's out of his mind.
That trailer obviously is from the English language version of this movie. It was filmed in Nice in the south of France at the Studios de la Vitrine, which are the same studios at which François Truffaut filmed the film within a film for La Nuit Americaine, Day for Night. So there you go. It's an old film studio, dates back to the 1920s. And it was used for this particular film. And there's some great location shooting as well. There's some beautiful villa overlooking the Côte d'Azur. Some really good country roads with little gypsy caravans plying their way up the country roads. There's also some bits and pieces filmed in Marseille as things go on. But yeah, it was filmed in the south of France, English language and French versions. Fortunately, the two English-speaking stars, Mel Ferrer and Christopher Lee, spoke fluent French. And so this made the whole thing possible. The story is very old. It was actually written in 1920 by Maurice Renard. It's an old novel called La Masse d'Orlak. And it tells the story of a concert pianist, Stephen Orlak, who has an accident and his hands need to be amputated. Of course, he's a concert pianist, so his hands are very important to him. In this particular version, he has a plane crash in a light plane going from London to Paris, and his hands are severely burnt and are removed. What he doesn't know at the start is that his hands were replaced by those of an executed criminal, a guy who's known as the Strangler of Paris. And so all that goes on, he's trying to get used to having the new hands. The conceit in this film is that hand transplants are a fairly smooth process, and hooking up all the bones and the sinews and the muscles and the nerves is something that can be done. In fact, there's a mad scientist involved in this particular one, played by Sir Donald Wolfert, called Professor Volchet, who does the operation and enables Orlak to continue with his life and his career. The movie's been filmed a number of times before and since. The original version of it starred Conrad Veidt, was filmed in Germany in 1924. There was also a 1935 American version, you might remember, called Mad Love, starring Peter Lorre, which takes things into some very dark and weird places. And Peter Lorre has some iconic pictures of him as the killer in the film. And he's as weird as Peter Lorre ever looked in any movie, really. But this version, we've got Christopher Lee instead. And there are a few variations in this version from the standard Hands of Orlak, of course, being given the hands of a strangler. We're going to know just from that and from the fact that it's a horror movie that then the hands start taking over and start controlling what Orlak is doing. This is not a good thing for him, nor is it a good thing for his fiancée, a lovely lady called Louise, played by Lucille Saint-Simon. While they're holidaying in the south of France, Lucille and Stephen Orlak, played by Mel Ferrer, have a few problems, one of which is the fact that Stephen tries to strangle her without knowing that he's doing it. He then flees. Obviously, he's in love with her. He doesn't want this to continue. He flees into Marseille and takes up a room in a sleazy little hotel where he has the misfortune of sharing the hotel with Nero the Magician, played by Christopher Lee. Now, Christopher Lee in this is a lot of fun. I really enjoy this as one of his roles. I don't think it's one of his best roles, but I think it's very much, he accepts the fact that it's an over-the-top role. He accepts the fact that it's a second part rather than a star part. And he really does go with it. Nero has a beautiful Eurasian assistant called Li Lang, played by an actress called Dani Carell, who was actually born in Vietnam back when it wasn't called Vietnam. She's still alive too, and she gets to sing a couple of nice little pop songs, including one called C'est Parti, which is kind of cool and groovy, particularly given the fact that she does sing it wearing an abbreviated for 1960 bikini. She's the magician's assistant on stage and helps him out with various things. He does a very hokey act. It's a very kind of second-rate magician's act. He has kind of animated marionettes of devils and skeletons that dance around the stage. He does the old trick with the coffin and the swords where the girl jumps into the coffin. He sticks swords through the sides of it. Girl comes out again. Okay. That kind of thing. And he's not really in love with that kind of a lifestyle. It's a kind of dying art, that kind of stage magic at the time. And Nero is looking for a way to gain a lot of money. And, of course, he sees Stephen Orlak there, knows that he has gone missing, and decides he's going to blackmail him to keep his secret so he can stay anonymous and away from the press and other people who are looking for him. Nero is not a nice guy, as you might guess by the fact that he's played by Christopher Lee. He fucks with Orlak's mind a lot. He threatens. He tries to do the old trick with Li Lang, his assistant, by getting her to seduce Orlak, then jumping in saying that he's her brother and threatening to beat him up unless he gives him money. He does all those kind of things. Orlak doesn't fall for that kind of stuff. But Christopher Lee then decides to take things up a notch or two and basically drive him insane. I'm not going to go into details because there's some really slick things that Nero does to try to drive Orlak insane. Now, as I said before, this one's been done a number of times before. There's even been a version in 2012 with the gender of the person who gets the transplant reversed. There's a French telemovie from 2012 called La Mains de Roxana, where a woman's hands are transplanted for the hands of a killer. I haven't seen it, and I don't know anything about it, but it sounds like it might be a worthy one to find if I can, and just see how things go with the genders reversed in. But this film has got a number of things going for it. It has beautiful locations. It has some actors we know, and even the smaller roles, there are some really nice character actors in there who you wouldn't expect to do secondary roles in this kind of film, except for the fact that it's 1960. You've got, of course, Donald Wolford, an old theatrical knight, who also did a Hammer film, Something of the Vampire, I think it was, a few years before this. He was right towards the end of his career, and I believe he may have been slightly fond of The Source, which is always a bad thing for people whose job is to spend their living remembering things. Let me see. Blood of the Vampire played Dr. Callistratus in that 1958, 2 years before this movie. And so he's in there as well, which makes things very interesting. You've got Basil Sidney's in there, an old English character actor, Felix Aylmer, Peter Reynolds, who I only know from a couple of other things, one of which is he played the fugitive in Devil Girl from Mars in the early 1950s. Also, if you're an Australian, and you know, and you were around in the 1960s, he did cigarette commercials for Wild Woodbine Cigarettes dressed up as a Victorian gentleman, which is a kind of an ironic thing because Peter Reynolds moved to Australia and continued his career as an actor in Australia. He appeared in a number of different dramas on television, particularly in Australia. But because he did the Wild Woodbine cigarette commercials, it was very unfortunate that he died smoking in bed in the early 1970s, which is not really the kind of look that you want to have for somebody who's touting your particular brand of coffin nails. So that's all I really know about Peter Reynolds. He was in 1975 he died. Now, there's also one scene which is quite interesting with Donald Pleasence in it. Donald Pleasence wearing a kind of very French-looking mustache for a change. And he just plays a minor character that comes in, has a few lines, and then leaves. But it's interesting to see him pop up in there as well. I'm sure there are any number of French character actors who turned up in this that with whom I'm not familiar, but the whole mixture of the French and the English stuff makes it a really interesting adaptation of the film. And there are a couple of other things as well. I mean, some people may see some aspects of the climax of this film as a watered-down version of it and a wussed-down version of it. But I don't really see it as that. I see it as a variation on a theme. And the emphasis is taken away from the hands forcing Orlach to strangle and concentrate on the fact that he's trying to get his musical career back on track, the fact that he's marrying his girlfriend, and the fact that he's got this unscrupulous stage magician who is trying to drive him insane so that he can scam a lot of money out of him. So that's where the emphasis goes with this. Now, Mel Ferrer is pretty good in the film. He's got some really great hands on him, which is always a good thing with this kind of a movie where you're playing somebody with hand transplants, and they're used to quite good effect in a number of different scenes. Mel Ferrer, for a long time, was married to Audrey Hepburn, which is kind of interesting. In fact, he was married to her at the time that he made this film. They'd done War and Peace together in the 1950s, and he'd done a number of other things. He played the Marquis de Maine in Scaramouche with Stuart Granger, for instance. Not a kind of A-list actor particularly. He did spend most of his career in Europe, even though he was an American. But in this one, he's pretty good, and he brings a bit more than is totally necessary to the role of Orlach, and does a pretty damn good job of it. But and the minor character actors, as I said, are very good. It's got a little bit of a Parisian kind of French feel to it as well, which makes it neither fish nor fowl in a way. It doesn't really sit comfortably with the Hammer kind of stuff, which is overwhelmingly and completely English. Hammer films, are, with a few exceptions like Maniac, which was filmed in the Camargue in the south of France, the one with Kerwin Matthews in it. Apart from a couple of exceptions like that, Hammer is overwhelmingly a British product, whereas this one sits between Hammer and French things like La Guerre of Versailles and the films of Georges Franju, for instance. It kind of sits between the two of them, which makes it a little more interesting than it might otherwise have been had it just been made in England or just made in France. It's got that kind of trans-channel appeal to it. And I kind of liked it. I wasn't expecting too much from it. I'd seen Mad Love, and I like Mad Love a lot. I haven't seen the 1924 one, though that is, I think, entirely on YouTube now, so I can pick it up if I need to. But this one, it's in black and white. It's got some great location scenes, and it does work as a kind of middling 1960 thriller where the supernatural elements and are kind of de-emphasized, and the nastiness of Christopher Lee, who's wearing the kind of rug with his hair come down over his forehead, which makes it even more interesting. Had they had anybody else in that role, I think it wouldn't have been anywhere near as interesting. And he does steal the movie from everybody else, except perhaps with the sole and memorable exception of Danny Carell dancing in an abbreviated bikini singing C'est parti. But anyway, leaving all that aside, I think it's a movie that's worth checking out. I don't think it's fantastically wonderful and over the top, but the Anglo-French nature of it improves it. And it's interesting seeing Christopher Lee getting to chew the scenery in something that doesn't involve fangs and necks at the time. And my theory is, and here's my theory about why a few people did this movie. Here you are, you're an English jobbing actor, you've got a little bit of success, and somebody says to you, spend a few weeks in the south of France making a film. You're going to jump for it. For a start, it's the south of France, and it's in the summertime. It's filmed in pretty warm weather. Why wouldn't you go to the Studio de la Victrine, spend a couple of weeks making a movie, and then spend some time on the south of France? I mean, it's a no-brainer there. Really a groovy and wonderful thing to do. But anyway, there's not too much else to say about Les Mains d'Orlach, the Hands of Orlach, except that It surprised me at how much fun it was. It's not to be taken seriously at all. It's the horror aspects of it are kind of about on level with some Hammer stuff at the time, but not too bad. And it's a nice little kind of halfway point between the early Hammer stuff, and it feels very much like a Hammer film in some ways, as I said. George Franju's stuff and the later stuff that came along. And I'm going to have to track down more and more, I think, of Christopher Lee's non-Hammer and non-well-known work, because I think he's kind of good in this, in a way that doesn't take anything away from anything else he's ever done, including Lord Summerisle in The Wicker Man, which I was speaking about with Liz just about 4 days ago. But anyway, there's not too much else to say about it. It is available on the usual slightly dodgy sites. From what I can see of the trailer of the English language version, I think the French one plays better. If you can get the French one, even with subtitles, I think it looks a little bit better for some reason than the English one. And it's not just me being a Francophile, isn't it, when I say that. I think it plays more smoothly, and the voices of the actors aren't dubbed, and whereas some of the French actors in the English language version were dubbed, which takes a little bit away from it. The movie was directed by a guy called Edmond T. Greville, who for a time in the 1930s was an assistant to René Clair and Abel Gance, which is kind of interesting too, which he does a really nice job of it. Particularly, there are some scenes that are dimly lit, and he does the chiaroscuro thing really well. But essentially, the film comes back to Christopher Lee wearing a Borsellino hat with a white tie and a black shirt and a spiffy suit, sitting just listening to what's going on around him so he can find a way to blackmail the poor bastard with the recycled hands. But that's all I've got for that one. So just write it down in your list and check it out. Let me know what you think. And I'm going to take a break now, and then I'm going to talk about a very different film, a 1950s techno thriller kind of thing by Ivan Tors. It wasn't directed by him, but he produced it, called Gog, starring Richard Egan and the lady who went on to marry Ivan Tors, in fact, Constance Dowling. Here's a bit of the trailer from it. It's a bit truncated at the front end, so it kind of starts in the middle of a sentence, but it gives you a bit of an idea what's going on.
Suddenly it became a Frankenstein of steel, out to destroy its makers. Thrilled to miracles of science beyond imagination. Light that melts steel from a station in space. Rays that destroy man's most destructive weapons. Love that conquers terror. A strangely, intensely exciting romance in a world all its own. Sound that kills.
So basically what we got is a 1950s science-based science fiction movie. It was produced by Ivan Tors, who people most remember for having produced the TV series Flipper in the 1960s. But Ivan Tors, interesting guy. He was actually born in Hungary and worked for the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, during World War II. And after the war, he was a screenwriter for MGM for a while. But he very much had an interest in science and the progress of science into the future. Gog is the third in a kind of unofficial and very vague series of movies. So in a sense, they form a trilogy based on an organization that Tors made up called the Office of Scientific Investigation, the OSI. The first one was The Magnetic Monster in 1951. The second one was Rider to the Stars in 1954. And Gog's the third one, which again was filmed in 1954. It was filmed very, very quickly too. They didn't mess around a lot with this particular movie. About 15 days on two sets in the Hal Roach Studios. And they did The exterior is at George Air Force Base in Victorville in California. The director was Herbert L. Strock, who'd done a little bit of direction, uncredited, for the previous two movies, and went on to make a few different things, nothing particularly fantastically wonderful. Did a lot of episodic TV in the 1950s and early 1960s. Did a couple of other things you might not remember. The Crawling Hand, he was the director of that as well. The Devil's Messenger, Rider on a Dead Horse. I'm going to have to find out about Rider on a Dead Horse because I like that as a title for a crime film. Let's see who was in it. Nobody famous. Basically, nothing there. So basically, he's jobbing, not particularly successful director. He's able to do things quickly. So, of course, he was very good for episodic TV. He did a few episodes of things like Sea Hunt and Highway Patrol, The Alaskans and Cheyenne. Maverick, he did an episode of Maverick as well. Bronco, Colt 45, all those kind of westerns in there. Died in 2005, but hadn't made anything since 1980. Which is kind of interesting. But anyway, I'll give you the pricey. I've got a fairly good one from Wikipedia. I'll just give you the first couple of paragraphs of the plot that'll get you going. Unaccountable deadly malfunctions begin occurring at a top-secret government facility under the New Mexico desert where the parts for a space station are being constructed. OSI agents are called in to investigate. Laboratory supervisor Dr. Van Ness, played by Herbert Marshall, calls in Dr. David Shepard, played by Richard Egan, a security agent from the Office of Scientific Investigation in Washington, to find the cause of the mysterious death. Working with Joanna Merritt, an OSI agent already in the facility, Constance Dowling, Shepard determines that the deaths among the lab's 150 top scientists are due to deliberate sabotage of NOVAC, Nuclear Operative Variable Automatic Computer, a central computer which controls all equipment in the underground facility. But it's harder to determine how the sabotage is done. The unseen enemy strikes again and again, snuffing out six scientists in quick succession, as well as Major Howard, the complex's chief of security. Eventually, Shepard determines that a powerful radio transmitter was secretly built into the NOVAC during its construction. Not going to go any further than that, but that's basically it. It's one of those kind of Cold War security things. You've got to beat the Russians into space, and the way they're going to get into space is kind of very, very unlike the way they really got into space. They're going to put up an enormous wheel of a space station as the first thing they put up into space. And the whole idea of the underground base in New Mexico is to get things set up so they can continue into space. And, yeah, that's not a bad thing in itself. There's a really good scene just before the title sequence, which is really cool, where a couple of scientists, a man and a woman, are working in a lab and basically freeze a monkey. They're trying to test suspended animation for long space journeys. So they got this cute little capuchin monkey. They set him up, freeze him solid, bring him back to life again, which is really cool, except for the fact that after they brought him back to life, the doctor who is in the, Dr. Hubertus, who's in the freeze chamber, suddenly realizes that the door slammed shut. Something shut the door and then turned up the cold. And you see Dr. Hubert is trying to get someone's attention. He's bashing on the windows and thumping around and getting really panicked. And his glasses are starting to ice up and his hair's starting to ice up. And eventually he gets to the stage where he freezes solid and you see him fall back into the fog and shatter. Then, of course, his assistant comes and finds him and the door slams shut on her as well. So basically, freeze monkeys. And there's always a chance that something is going to freeze you. And that's kind of cool. That's a nice start. It's a little bit off the wall, but it gives you the fact that some unseen force is fucking around with this secret base and killing off all of the top scientists, which is a good way to do things. So Richard Egan comes in playing Dr. David Shepard. Richard Egan is in a bunch of movies that I like and a few TV series that I like. He's in A Summer Place, which is one of those 1950s soap opera-y movies. He's in The 300 Spartans, which is kind of cool. He's in a very good crime film from the early 1950s, which also stars Victor Mature, called Violent Saturday, which I recommend. And in the 60s, he went on to do TV series like Empire and Redigo. He's, you know, kind of a hunky guy with a suntan and good teeth and a good head of hair. And kind of one of those guys that they needed in a whole bunch of beam pictures and in TV series when you needed a man of action. He was a kind of perfectly looking man of action for that kind of thing. He looked good in a suit. He looked good with his shirt off. And could do the job. Clenched his teeth a little bit when he spoke, but again, he was a good jobbing actor, and I kind of like Richard Egan. I'd seen him in so much stuff when I was a kid, I kind of took a shine to him. Constance Dowling, a lovely blonde lady, not a fantastically gifted actor, but she went on to marry the boss, which is not a bad thing. Herbert Marshall's probably the most interesting person in this film, because Herbert Marshall had a long career in cinema. His full name is Herbert Bro Falcon Marshall, which goes to show you that he's from a fairly upper-class background. I remember him most from The Razor's Edge, the 1946 Razor's Edge with Tyrone Power, where he played Somerset Maugham as a heterosexual. Yeah, he's been in any number of things. Interesting thing is, he only had one leg. One of his legs was amputated at the hip during World War One. A sniper shot him through the knee, and there were a bunch of operations, but of course, this is before antibiotics, so they eventually had to amputate it at the hip. And he hid the fact throughout his career that he had a prosthetic limb. He had a bit of a limp, and yeah, there were a number of actors who had a limp, but no, his was cut off at the hip. He was one of the more successful people with a disability in the history of cinema, in a sense. Really long career, going from 1929 all the way through to 1965. And a good jobbing actor, as they say. So I like him in here. He was able to play scientists plausibly because he was an intelligent guy and he could get all the jargon right. And in this one, he gives a lot of fun to the stuff that he needs to say for the particular movie. Now, GOG was originally filmed to be shown in 3D. There is a 3D version of it out there. In fact, there are some clips of the 3D, anamorphic 3D process on YouTube. But problem is that, like a few other films, 3D was being phased out in 1954 when this was released. It had its heyday and then was diminishing, so they showed the widescreen color version of it in most of the cinemas rather than showing the 3D version. And to be honest with you, for something that's all based inside a science lab, with the exception of a few shots of helicopters and jet aircraft, it's not a movie that kind of lends itself easily to the 3D. You can see some bits where they're shooting flamethrowers at robots and stuff like that, where it would have looked spectacular in 3D. But for the most part, the 3D is not essential in any way to the movie. But of course, you can argue that with any film, that 3D is not essential to it, even for modern day 3D with things like the Marvel franchise movies. You don't really need it, but it's a nice little gimmick to have there if it's available to you. But the name GOG represents one of two robots that they have in the underground base, Gog and Magog, who are named after a couple of mythological Welsh giants, which is quite an obscure reference for a 1950s science fiction movie. The robots are kind of, they look a little bit like Tom Servo from Mystery Science Theater 3000, except on tank tracks and with a lot more arms. They've got kind of manipulator arms and a flamethrower thing at the front of them. I'm not too sure why in an underground base you need a robot with a flamethrower on it, but they've got one. And the two robots do move around pretty well for these sort of things. I don't know whether they had people inside them or, yeah, well, they probably would have had people inside them and then had some of the arms manipulated by wires or something like that. But they work pretty well. Unfortunately, they look more comical than menacing, and they're supposed to be menacing in a couple of things. In fact, they do strangle a bunch of people, including William Shallot, who's in there playing one of the lab scientists. But this movie I kind of like because I like the idea of that 1950s attitude to science, that you've got a problem. Science is there to fix it. A lot of science fiction movies you see of the 1950s are, science has created a problem. We need science to fix it. And I kind of like that approach. I don't like the approach of science has caused a problem. Let's blow the fuck out of it before we understand it. That kind of doesn't sit well with me. I like the idea of science fixing its own shit. And in this case, well, it's arguable. The robot Novak in the lab is being manipulated externally. In this case, it's from a slightly unusual external source. But it's got to be one of the first times in movie history that there's computer hacking, because the computer does have a kind of transceiver inside it, which is implanted when it was created, which enables an external third party to manipulate the whole lab. Everything's set up in the lab to be controlled by Novak, because there's a precision to the way the computer handles scientific instruments. They've got a whole bunch of things like a heliostat kind of thing, where they bounce beams of light down into the lab from the sun and use it as a way of a solar weapon, in a sense. Intense beams of light being used to melt things and burn things. And they're looking at that as a potential weapon for the space platform they've got. Not too sure I want anybody having a death ray from outer space, but apparently in the world of the movie, the Americans having one is okay because they'd never actually use it. I'm not too sure about that given the last 60 years of human history, but leaving that aside, there are some good bits where that intense light beam is used to great effect. There are some experiments with things like centrifuges and how people can handle being in a centrifuge. There are also some scenes where sound is used as a weapon. So you've got all of those tropes that are part of 1950 science. You've got sonic weapons. You've got light being used as a weapon. This is before lasers. Lasers didn't get invented until 1959, about 5 years after this film. But they still, the beams of light kind of do work like a laser, which is kind of interesting. And whoever is manipulating Novak does use it to try to fry a couple of scientists, which is not really playing fair, if you ask me, but that's how it is in the film. And then they've got Gog and Magog, who are then instructed to overload the atomic pile in the underground complex, therefore spilling radioactivity everywhere and ending up with a kind of mini Chernobyl kind of scenario there. There are some aspects to it which are kind of laughable as well. The hero and the heroine do get a large dose of radiation towards the end of the film, but they're okay in hospital and stuff, flirting with each other in hospital not too long after that. There's no indication at all that anybody's told them that they'll probably end up with cancer throughout the rest of their life, which will be shorter than expected. None of that kind of stuff. Yes, we got an overdose of radiation. We've got to spend some time in hospital. Everything will be okay. So there's a little bit of that there, and you can find that kind of stuff laughable. But I do like the fact that they're actually trying to use real science in a science fiction movie for a change, or an extrapolation on real science, which is to their credit. They're not just making shit up like giant insects or anything like that. They're trying to be plausible in, A, the science that they use, B, the reasons they use it, and C, how it will play out. And that's kind of cool, and I think is something that's kind of rare and a little bit unusual at the time. They really, most of the science fiction movies at the time used the buzzwords of science, if you know what I mean, without using the fact that people have to work hard to make science work. And they do talk in the movie about people working for years and years to perfect the things that they're working on, and the trial and error and the experimentation that's required to get new discoveries happening. Now, whether you agree with the reasons why they're doing it, to try to beat the Russians and to put a space platform with a giant mirror on top of it so they could fly anywhere they like on the world, whether you consider that a good thing or not. But the habits and the worldview of science is there, which makes it a lot more interesting than people who spout out a string of buzzwords and then go and do something that's totally unscientific. You get a lot of movies, that, particularly at the time, and to this day, that do a lot of that. They do the hand-waving, but they don't actually base it in any kind of reality. But GOG's one of those movies that was probably shown in drive-ins in the 1950s as a good, honest little B science fiction movie. A lot of people have great memories of it, seeing it on TV as a kid. And it's it does show you that there's a continuity in science fiction film from the very, very early days, way before this, up to the modern science fiction movies. A movie like The Machine, the one that I mentioned briefly at the start of the podcast, that's on a continuum between, say, Frankenstein in 1931, or even the Frankensteins that were done much earlier there, and with GOG sitting in the middle there, people, you know, experimenting with the frontiers of science and something going desperately wrong. In this case, sabotage, but something going wrong and then needing to fix it. The way they fix things in GOG is a little bit primitive. Flamethrowering robots isn't a particularly scientific way of doing stuff, but there you go. That's how it rolls sometimes. But I do like this film. I like the fact that it's got Richard Egan in it, and I like him a lot. I like the three movies in the OSI trilogy, Magnetic Monster, Riders to the Stars, and this one. They don't get things as they turned out to be in real history, but they do have an honest approach to science and a very naive faith in the ability of science to do good things when it's in the hands of the military. I think that history has proved that there are misuses of science which can very easily be done and are done in our name and with our money. But this, again, is from a more naive time and a time when there were genuine tensions in the world that threatened it. And, of course, it's easy to believe the simplistic worldview when it's us versus them rather than us versus some nebulous bunch of different threats the way we have it now. When there was a bipolar thing, well, bipolar, I don't mean as in the disorder, I mean at two poles of things like Nazis versus good guys or the Soviets versus the Americans, that kind of thing. When you've got a bipolar tension in the world, it's easy to look at the simplistic things and accept them. Whereas we live in a much more complex world where there are things like non-governmental players involved doing things. And then, of course, you've got Putin, but I'm not going to go into that. But anyway, this movie, 1950s, Cold War, science thriller. It's a bit of fun. It's got some groovy robots in it. People get frozen and then shatter, which is never a bad thing in a science fiction movie. And it's a lot of fun. So I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, I'm going to see if I can rake up some feedback for us. That's just a little bit of the soundtrack from the 1982 Larry Cohen movie, Cue the Winged Serpent, by Robert O. Raglan. That movie's a lot of fun. I'm going to have to rewatch that one soon. I do like it. I like Michael Moriarty in it. And, and giant dinosaurs flying over New York City. You've got to love that kind of stuff. But anyway, there isn't any feedback, but I do have a question. I'm going to put out a question because I put out a question last time I did Paleo Cinema, and I got some response to it. So I've got to obviously give you guys a trigger for some feedback. Which science fiction, fantasy, or horror movie should be remade and why? I know there are a lot that should never be touched and should never be remade, but I want to know which ones you reckon should be remade and why should they be remade now? So send your feedback through to cultguru@gmail.com or go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and let me know. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. I'll be back in 2 weeks with something else entirely. We're getting up towards the National Science Fiction Convention Continuum in the June long weekend at the start of June. So I'm going to try to get a few people on board there and get a few people involved in the podcast a little bit. But anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves, watch the skies, enjoy your science fiction, fantasy, and horror viewing. And I'll be back in a little bit with a Paleo Cinema and then again with the Martian Drive-In podcast. Take care of yourselves, eh? Bye.